Coming up, our panel of top reporters looks back at the major religion and ethics stories of 2011.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. The estate of William J. Carter, the Jane Henson Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. As 2011 draws to a close, we take our annual look back at what we think were the most interesting and important religion and ethics stories of the year. We begin with a reminder from Kim Lawton of what some of those stories were.
As the gap between rich and poor widened this year, people of faith stepped up their efforts to help those hard hit by the recession. Some, especially conservative activists, supported massive cuts to the federal budget, arguing that it was immoral to leave debt to future generations. But a broad-based interfaith coalition argued that it was immoral to make spending cuts that would hurt already vulnerable people. Thousands participated in a prayer and fasting campaign to protect programs that help the poor in the U.S. and around the world. When frustration about the economy spilled out into the streets with the Occupy movement, many religious groups provided spiritual and material support. Local congregations led interfaith worship services and offered sanctuary to evicted protesters. Theologians debated whether Jesus would have camped out with the Occupy movement. The role of religion in American politics remained controversial. GOP presidential hopefuls courted religious voters, especially evangelicals who are very important in the primaries. Many candidates made explicitly religious appeals. While some concern about the idea of a Mormon president lingered, especially among evangelicals, issues of character and marital fidelity appeared to generate more attention. In several parts of the Arab world, popular uprisings toppled regimes and reignited debates about the role of Islam in government. New successes for Islamist political parties raised concerns about human rights and especially the situation for dissenters and religious minorities. In Egypt, Muslims and Christians protested side by side in Tahrir Square, but there were several dramatic attacks against the nation's Coptic Christian community. In Syria, protesters were met with a brutal crackdown from government forces. American ethicists and religious leaders debated the morality of military intervention in Libya. Some said U.S. participation in the NATO action was justified on humanitarian grounds, but others argued that it did not meet the criteria of the just war doctrine. The killings of Osama bin Laden and extremist American-born cleric Anwar al-Awlaki generated ethical debate about the U.S. use of force in non-combat zones. There was also debate about the growing U.S. use of weaponized unmanned drones. American religious groups were divided over the Palestinians' request for official U.N. recognition as a state. Many Jews and evangelical Christians opposed the statehood bid, but some Christian and Muslim groups supported the idea, saying it was time for Palestinians to have their own state. The 10th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks prompted new examination of the state of interfaith relations. Many Muslim Americans complained of a continuing rise of anti-Islamic discrimination. On Capitol Hill, Republican Congressman Peter King sponsored hearings on what he called the radicalization of American Muslims. There was acrimonious debate in several communities over proposed bans against Sharia or Islamic law. At the same time, the 9/11 anniversary highlighted many projects where diverse faith communities have come together in new ways. Several humanitarian disasters stretched the resources of faith-based groups. Religious organizations continued efforts in Haiti after last year's devastating earthquake and cholera epidemic, and they offered aid in the wake of the Japanese earthquake. Many faith-based groups mobilized to help millions affected by a major famine in East Africa. There were also challenges here at home with deadly tornadoes, severe flooding, and a rare East Coast earthquake that caused an estimated $15 million worth of damage at Washington National Cathedral. But 2011 brought some occasions for celebration as well. Christians commemorated the 400th anniversary of the King James Version of the Bible. And in Rome, on a record-breaking timetable, Pope John Paul II was beatified, bringing him one step closer to sainthood.
Kim, a great summary. Kim Lawton is managing editor of Religion and Ethics News Weekly. Kevin Ekstrom is the editor-in-chief of Religion News Service. And E.J. Dion is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a columnist for the Washington Post, and a professor at Georgetown University. Welcome to each of you.
Thank you.
I guess my pick for the year would be the Arab Spring and everything that flowed out of it, leading to the Occupy movement all over the United States. E.J., what do you make of that?
Well, I think the Arab Spring is one of those events that could have the longest-term impact on the nature of the world. I mean, when you're thinking about how many Arab and Muslim countries were transformed by this, we don't know where this is going yet, but it was striking that this movement was a very broad alliance of people, some who are Islamists, some who are secular, some from the Christian minority, all saying we're sick and tired of corruption and dictatorship. Now, it's playing out differently in different places. We don't know where it's going, but it was a very liberating moment. I'm not sure it led to Occupy Wall Street, although some of the Occupy Wall Streeters talked about an inspiration. But it was a year in which protesters of a lot of different kinds changed the world.
Mm-hmm. And it really did bring up this whole question about when you have a democracy, then what is the role of religion? And many countries obviously have been wrestling with this. We wrestle with it. But in Islamic countries, that's a question. And how do you form a new government, write a constitution that acknowledges Islam, but then what does that mean in terms of the laws and the people and the treatment of minorities and women? And so all of those issues are being debated, and people are watching because there are a lot of Muslim countries that have been struggling with this issue.
And the irony that democracy might lead to a lot of things we don't like.
Right, and I think Kim put her finger on something, which is, you know, we've had Christian democratic movements in Western countries for a long time, where there was some kind of linkage with between religion and the state, and yet an acknowledgement of the importance of religious freedom and democracy. There are religious parties inside Israel that compete with secular parties, and so the real question, or one of the real questions, is whether similar developments will take place in the Arab world. And I think, and we've seen certainly in countries like Indonesia, where you can have parties that are Islamic but also democratic.
And I think what's interesting here at home on the Occupy movement was it's not a religious movement per se, although there has been religious involvement, but it prompted a lot of really heavy religious and moral arguments about fairness and equity and how we spread wealth or how we hold people accountable. And so there were some fairly profound, I think, moral questions that were raised by the Occupy movement.
And EJ, a year ago we were all preoccupied with the Tea Party movement. The year passed, and we're all preoccupied on the left with the Occupy movement. What happened?
Well, I think what the two movements had in common is a lot of people in the country are unhappy with the results of the economic downturn, the state of the economy. Right through the 2010 election, the inclination, the strongest organizing was on the side that said this is all government's fault and we have to tear down government. I think Occupy really changed our political debate in fundamental ways. A lot of people had been talking about rising economic inequality, which has really been happening over a 30 or 40 year period. It took this movement with a certain kind of media savvy to grab a lot of people's attention, to get all kinds of people, including conservatives, to talk about what rising inequality means and whether we ought to do something about it.
I'm intrigued by the amount of religious participation there is in the Occupy movement, just as there was in the Tea Party movement. There were a lot of evangelicals that had some, you know, still do have some affinity with the Tea Party. On the religious left, there's a lot of participation, not just with chaplains, which they do have in the movement, but in talking about some of the language and helping behind the scenes with the strategy, and also in some of the rhetoric that's being used. You hear things like greed is evil. That's a moral kind of a calculation, you know. And inequality and the gap between rich and poor, that's wrong, it's evil. Those are all moral issues. And that's the influence, I think, of the religious community. African American clergy have joined in on this and wanted to get more involved, and they see it as an extension of the civil rights movement.
And this is the 25th anniversary of the Catholic bishop's very important statement at the time, economic justice for all. And some of us at Georgetown went back and were talking about this. And in a lot of ways, that statement from 25 years ago, parts of it could be a manifesto for this movement demanding economic justice.
But do you hear in all this something not only that protests what we have, but that goes on to say we ought to change it fundamentally, change the system, the political system, the economic system? Is there that in there too or not?
Well, I think the Occupy movement has been very consciously not about particular demands. Some people have criticized them for that, although I think historically a lot of movements change things not by putting up a program, but by saying we need to move in a different direction. But I think a lot of these movements are more reformist than they are revolutionary.
Right.
There's clearly a lot of frustration with Congress and the way Washington is working. But I still think even some of the more radical elements of some of these movements are not looking to overturn the system. They just think it needs to be a whole lot better than it is.
Yeah. Meanwhile, there's been this amazing campaign on the Republican side for the nomination for president. And in that, Mitt Romney's Mormonism comes up, as you pointed out, Kim, in your piece. Is that going to hurt him?
I think it will be a challenge for him to get through the primaries. If he can make it through the primaries and gets the nomination and can get to the general election, I think it will be less of an issue. But I think at this point, in the last couple of weeks, what we've seen is it's not his Mormonism that's Romney's Achilles heel. It's the conservative distrust of him. And you've seen it, you know, Romney has stayed fairly stable in the polls. He's never really gets above 20-23%, and everyone's looking for a plan B or another option, but they're not really falling in love with any of them. So I think his problems are more about him and less about his Mormonism right now.
What's been the role of religious conservatives in the Republican campaign?
Well, I think religious conservatives have been fragmented in this election. I think they kind of wanted to rally behind someone. And it's their situation is much like that of other kinds of conservatives in the party, including Tea Party conservatives, where a potential champion, for example, Rick Perry, who soared in the polls after he got into the race and looked like he might be the person who could unite Tea Party conservatives, religious conservatives, and other kinds, and then had a whole series of problems, and he sort of collapsed again. Michelle Bachmann was a favorite of some of them for a while. Now Newt Gingrich has picked up some of that support. So I think that, you know, this election has been different, say, than the last one, where a very large number of religious conservatives rallied behind Mike Huckabee. Some, I think, for anti-Mormon reasons, but others simply because Huckabee was an engaging evangelical leader.
But it took them a while last time around to rally around Huckabee, yeah, which was one of his frustrations, and that's been the case this time around, too, that they haven't been able to coalesce around one candidate. And they are very important in this primary season, as we said. Last time around, about 40%, more than 40% of all GOP primary voters were evangelicals. And in early states like Iowa and South Carolina, that goes to 60%. And so if you want to be the GOP candidate, you've got to get a significant number of those votes. And yeah, there's something about they haven't done around Mitt Romney. Some of them like Ron Paul. So
it's very interesting. The first three states, you've got Iowa where the caucuses have a very high weight evangelical participation. Mm-hmm. Then you've got New Hampshire,
right,
which is a somewhat more secular and quite a bit more secular and libertarian state. And then you go back to South Carolina next, which is, again, a place where evangelicals are important.
2011 was the 10th anniversary of 9/11. What do we know about U.S. attitudes toward Muslims, and how has that changed over this time? Kevin?
They haven't really gotten much better. I think that's the simple answer. You saw this year with the hearings that Kim mentioned about radicalization on Capitol Hill, the brouhaha that we've seen in the last couple of weeks over a Muslim reality TV show. A lot, the anti-Muslim sentiment actually creeped up a little bit after bin Laden's death in May. A lot of people said, well, if we get rid of bin Laden, then maybe people will feel better about Muslims. And actually the opposite happened. So things continue to remain tense. I think what's been really interesting to watch in the last couple weeks has been this kind of counter backlash to the Muslim reality TV show, where Lowe's, the hardware store, pulled its ads from the show under conservative pressure. And now everyone's threatening to boycott Lowe's because they don't think that the show is getting a fair shake and that Muslims aren't getting a fair shake. So there is a bit of sympathy, I think, in some to some degree for Muslims being under attack.
What do you make of the efforts going on in many states to whip up fear of Sharia, of Islamic law?
Well, you know, I think one of the disconcerting things that's happened in attitudes toward Muslims is over time it's become more of a partisan and ideological issue, which was not the case in the days immediately after 9/11, partly because President Bush made some very strong statements about Muslims being Americans, being our brothers and sisters. But now you've seen this issue become more politicized. So it tends to be in very conservative states, paradoxically, often states with very, very small Muslim populations. But I think in a way we are, as a country, trying to deal with Muslims as a new reality in our country in much the same way that we dealt with Catholic immigrants 100 years ago or more as a new reality in our country. My colleagues at Brookings and the Public Religion Research Institute did a poll this year. We found overwhelming support for religious freedom and the rights of minorities, 9 Americans in 10. But on particular questions about Muslims, nearly half were uncomfortable with mosques in their neighborhood. Nearly half thought that Muslim and American values were incompatible. A lot of the same things that are said about Muslims were said about Catholics, that Catholics owed allegiance to a foreign power, that they weren't fully democratic. I take some of these numbers in a more positive way, that you see quite a bit of movement toward toleration and embrace, but still some holding back. I think it'll take a long time. Younger Americans are much more open than older Americans.
And so much of many Americans' views of Muslims and Islam have been tied to the war on terror. Right. And so that's an additional complication that also then brings in foreign policy and lots of politics as well. So that's been a complicating factor that many American Muslims are frustrated about, that they're broad-brushed with a whole bunch of people around the world that they have nothing to do with.
The last U.S. troops from Iraq have been coming back. What do you all make of the welcome that they've received and of people's feelings generally about the end of the Iraq War?
I've been surprised at the fact that prior to our entry into the Iraq War in the religious community, this was a huge issue and there was so much debate. Is this a just war? Should we be doing this? There were protests in the streets. And now that it's winding down, I haven't heard as much moral conversation from ethicists and religious leaders about what did it all mean now that it's done and what did we leave behind? People were talking about, do we have an ethical responsibility to that country? And I don't hear it being framed in that way. And I found that interesting.
Yeah. And I think it's a very different reception than the troops coming home from Vietnam obviously got. And I think a lot of people are happy about that. They're proud that their veterans are coming home. But I've been surprised by how muted the reaction has been. I think, along what Kim was saying, that it's almost like you don't know that it's happening out there.
You know, I'm struck that on the one hand, the reaction is very different than the reaction to World War II, where we had a clear victory, we announced it. On the other hand, it's also not like Vietnam, where we saw folks evacuated by helicopter from the roof of the embassy. I think Americans decided they wanted to get out of this war several years ago, and the Obama administration decided that the only way to get out was in a slow and responsible way. So I'm not surprised by the quiet reaction, but you're absolutely right. It is our reaction to the veterans and an appreciation is so much greater now, and I thought we did a terrible job as a country in sort of honoring the service of Vietnam veterans. It took us years to honor what they did for the country.
And we have seen a lot of religious involvement in working and ministering to some of these returning troops. And you know, not only those who are wounded physically, but emotionally and spiritually, those wounds linger. And so I have seen a lot of religious energy put into that as well.
Kevin, it's been almost 10 years since the terrible scandal broke about the Catholic sex abuse of children. Where does that stand? Bring us up to date on that. What happened in this year?
Well, it had a couple things. One, you saw this process enter the criminal justice system, the secular system. So you had a grand jury in Philadelphia indict a top church official for shuffling priests from one place to another. And in Kansas City, you had the first bishop ever criminally indicted for not reporting a known abuser. The other interesting thing that happened was it spread in a way to Penn State. You know, the church has long argued that this is not just a church problem, that this is a problem in schools and universities and the Boy Scouts and wherever else. And this is the first big sort of example of that we saw. But what was, I think, most interesting was mid-year, the bishops put out a long-anticipated report on what they call the causes and context of this problem. What went wrong, basically? And they couldn't really come up with a simple, decisive answer. What they did, essentially, was they said the whole culture got off track in the 60s, and the church got really swept up in that. And that's sort of the big problem that they could point to. But there was no single cause that they could find.
And the headlines were on that. Woodstock made them do it. And of course, that's not what the church wanted for PR. Well, that was the media too, but still, that was what some people took away.
And of course, the problem on the scandal was not the 60s culture. I think what it created was a crisis of authority inside the church, because a lot of the anger was not simply at the abuse itself, as much anger as there was at that, but how long it took for the church to come to terms with it. But again, the Penn State thing, the Penn State events suggest a very similar pattern of institutions being slow to respond.
What about immigration and the churches? What's going on there? What's been going on this year?
Well, in Alabama, you had one of these get tough immigration laws that was passed that took effect. And the United Methodist Bishop in Alabama.
And Arizona.
And in Arizona. The Methodist Bishop in Alabama said it's the meanest immigration law in the country. There are great fears that it would penalize churches for assisting immigrants, whether they're legal or not. And now certain parts of that law were thrown out and they're on appeal. So the churches for right now are in the clear, but there's a great concern within the religious community that their hands are being tied in their ability to minister to immigrants of one stripe or another.
Our time is almost up, but I don't want it to run out without asking you, as you look back on the year, what was the most intriguing story that you saw, or the one that got the least attention that should have gotten a lot more? Who wants to begin? EJ?
I was much taken by the Vatican's Pontifical Commission on Peace and Justice's critique of the economy that made you wonder, is Pope Benedict going to show up at one of these encampments of Occupy Wall Street? Because it was a very tough critique of capitalism. It didn't say get rid of the market system, but it raised a series of moral questions. And I'd like to think, and this happened in other traditions as well, I'd like to think that we can have, at the end of this downturn, a serious moral conversation about how you create a just and competitive economic system.
Mm-hmm. What do you see?
I was really struck by the sale of the Crystal Cathedral in Southern California. You had this institution that went bankrupt, and I think it's a microcosm of sort of the shifts that are going on in the American religion.
It was a symbol of
Protestant dominance, yeah. and it's symbolic of these shifts that are going on in the American religious landscape, where white, mainline, aging Protestants are literally losing ground. Literally, to Catholics, primarily fueled by Hispanic immigration. It's fascinating.
Hmm. I was struck by the number of religious successes I saw in the pop culture world. We had several books on the New York Times bestseller list about heaven and hell, including one that created a huge amount of controversy within the evangelical community by an evangelical pastor who had a more expansive view of who's going to hell. We saw the Book of Mormon on Broadway sweeping the Tonys. We had a movie called Courageous by a church in Georgia making over $33 million, and that's still making money every day. You know, just a lot of things like that. And of course, who could forget Tim Tebow and the Denver Broncos quarterback who made kneeling in prayer sort of a cultural phenomenon, generated a lot of controversy, but still got a lot of people talking about the public display of religion.
And he won a lot of games.
And well.
Our time is up, I'm sorry to say. Happy Christmas and happy Hanukkah to all our viewers and to Kevin Ekstrom, E.J. Dion, and Kim Lawton. I'm Bob Abernethy. Next week, our annual look ahead to the stories we expect in 2012. There's much more on our website, including a look at some of the prominent people in the world of religion who passed away in 2011. You can comment on all our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, music from the centennial celebration of the St. Olaf Christmas Festival in Northfield, Minnesota.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. The estate of William J. Carter, the Jane Henson Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Be more. PBS.